Well, hello, hello, everybody. Welcome to another installment of Show to Be with Mike G, the show of life, the show of documentaries, the show of art, composition, scotch, and so much more. Today, we sit down and chat with Stephen Corona, the Texas market manager for Compass Box Whiskey. I've interviewed a few folks from the team. Brilliant culture there, lots of creativity, and some of the damn finest whiskeys I've ever tried in my life. So it was great to finally get to talk to the Houston native himself, Stephen, in Austin here recently. We talk about a lot of different things, and it's great getting to know him, and I think we'll be friends going forward. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy this great chat with Stephen Corona of Compass Box Whiskey.
Yeah, I mean, this is another one of those occasions, Art and Decadence, the name, where the name and the sort of marketing, the label matches what you expect to have and what you experience when you try the whiskey. And we do that on purpose. I mean, scotch is this like kind of complicated category that's not very user-friendly for people outside of like the scotch drinkers, right? And the mission of Compass Box has always been to, you know, make the world of scotch whiskey a more interesting place and through that invite more people into the fold. And so, you know, to reach that, we wanted the labels to always sort of, and the names, to speak to what you're going to get in the glass.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we do it better than other times, you know, here and there. But this one, I think we nailed it because this is decadent and rich and, you know, artful in a way.
It is. And that's one of the things it's like, people make, so the way that records are made right now, and believe me, I'm not going to go on a tangent, but they are really single driven, right? And the Beatles, when they were writing records, it was very, very singles-driven. I don't know that Bowie was as much. I couldn't really say. But I know that the Beatles built albums around releasing singles. And so I always feel like it's like, what's the next release? What's the newest release from Compass Box? What are y'all going to put out? Because it's a different vibe. It's a different blend. It's a different aesthetic. How does that prove maybe to be difficult when you're going into a bar and be like, well, yeah, the one you really love, that aesthetic, yeah, we just made it that one time? Because that's like something that I find interesting about Compass Box.
That is a hard part when you love the core range of whiskeys, but then you have someone tell you how much they loved, you know, this is not a luxury whiskey or Ultramarine or one of these previous limiteds, and you're like, that's cool, I'm really glad you like that one. We made, you know, a couple hundred cases of that. can you try this new one? Or can you get really into one of the ones we make year-round, please?
Just please.
There are a handful of bars I go to, and they're like, oh, we're huge supporters. And they are, and that's great. And I appreciate them, love them, but they literally have, like, 10 limited editions on the back bar, right? not one of the everyday ones that we make. So,
So I love it, and I feel that way, that I'm sure that when Warhol took pictures, I saw a picture of Diane Lane the day that Andy Warhol took from 1984. I was like, wait a minute, they like were in the same room and shit. But it just captures this moment and it never exists again. Is there something about the culture of Compass Box? And I know many of the folks that work over there, but is there something to it that's, let's capture the beauty of now and then move on? I know it's a tough question, but that's, I kind of look at it like that. It's this beautiful capture of
I love the way you put that. I'm not sure how much a certain moment plays into each expression, but what I do like, and this is true, is that they start with an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that idea, you know, it's in one place, and by the time the blend is done, you arrive somewhere completely different. But it always starts with an idea. We want to try to express this thing.
Yeah.
And it could be based on a historical, artistic, you know, movement. It could be some time in history. It could be just some vibe.
Right.
But the whiskeys all start with ideas and then get blended, you know, to reach that point. They still have to be delicious, obviously. That's the main thing. But they're kind of, you know, they're intellectual in a way.
They are. Yep. And I think what's interesting, man, you watch a lot of movies. I know you kind of went to U of H.
I do love film. My interest at U of H was more documentary, though.
I see.
I wanted to go to dangerous places and cover wars and conflicts and stuff like that. So that's
That's because you're still here. So the despite the danger, you're still here.
Yeah. Well, and stories need to be told, and not everyone's cut out to do that kind of stuff. And I say that and never really went and did it. So.
Right.
But that was more my interest. Although I do love films, especially the sort of headier, deeper, thoughtful kind.
Have you heard of American Fiction?
Is that a film? Or?
It's a brand new film. Came out. It's good. The best supporting actor. Oh, come on. I can't recall his name. He's great, but he's up for best supporting actor. I think it's best original screenplay and things. But there's a scene that's actually quite striking, and I'm going to send it to you because it involves a particular brand, not Compass Box, but another big brand. And at some point, the writer, he writes for a joke, something that he thinks everybody will just get, right? But he does it as like a fuck you to the system, right? It's like, it's the Circle Jerks writing a 3-minute pop song or something. It doesn't make any sense. Or Bad Religion writing a slow jam, right? Which they attempted in the 80s. But that's not what they are. They're a punk band. Yep. And so it's one of those things because he sat so true to his guns. He was so fast and affixed to making art. And I appreciated that about him. But he realized that a lot of people just simply won't get it. Is that ever like a challenge? That people, one, Scotch is already an uphill battle.
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge every day, especially in Scotch whiskey and probably in certain other categories. There's a lot of misconceptions, you know, there's a lot of ignorance, and then there's a lot of like biases out there, especially around Scotch. And sometimes you talk to someone who knows just enough to be dangerous.
Yeah. Yes, right.
They don't want to talk to you because they see blend in the name, and they are a single malts guy, and that's the good stuff, and you can get out of here with your little blend brand, right? And
right.
And you know, so it is a challenge. It is a challenge to go against people's preconceived notions or try to show them a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
It seems difficult. So talking about going to distant lands, I've never been to Magnolia, Texas. Were you born and raised in Magnolia, Texas?
No, I was born in the Inner Loop, and like it's Bel Air, but like,
okay,
not where all the good restaurants are. Like in the Loop, in a nice neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
And my parents sort of slowly moved further and further away from the city.
Really?
They're very much not city folk. Where I am, we're quite different in many ways.
And, were did they grow up in Texas as well, but lived in more agrarian places?
No, they grew up in Bel Air, went to Bel Air High School, and, you know, and...
what changed?
You know, well, I don't want to get too heavy, but, you know, I think they became fundamentalist Christians in their early 20s and late teens, and that sort of informed their worldview. And if you've never been in those circles, like Southern Baptist, right?
Yeah. Oh, my dad's Baptist.
Okay, well, yes. Okay, so, you know, the city is kind of the place where a lot of bad, dangerous people are.
Can we use air quotes?
Yeah,
bad stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Happens, yeah, right? Yep. And you know, in the countries where the good, you know, heartland types are, right?
Hardworking Americans.
Exactly. where all the pickup trucks are and all that. Right. Yes. And so they slowly sort of moved away from the city. So I experienced a very urban, like Inner Loop environment, all the way to Magnolia, where I ended my sort of being a kid years, and then went out on my own. So
you go to high school there?
I did. Okay. In fact, I was homeschooled. So
really?
The only public schooling I ever went to was high school, and that was Magnolia High School.
Oh, kidding. Yeah, so was that an extent? So this, I cast no judgment. I am not a judgmental person. My dad particularly grew up in small town Indiana, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a complicated thing. He's like, he's my dad, but I got a different dad, whatever, right? He doesn't like Austin. There's a couple of reasons he probably doesn't like Austin.
Yep.
But did you ever feel... Now knowing and being worldly and cultured now, I just got back from Portugal and stuff. Did you ever feel kind of stifled in that moment that like maybe you weren't allowed to see the world and the diversity that existed in Texas, not necessarily in Magnolia? No shade to Magnolia. Never been over there.
Yeah, it's a perfectly fine place. You know. I felt like I needed to get out of there. And then as soon as I'm old enough, I'm going to a cool place like New York or L.A. Funny thing is, I spent, you know, most of my life in Houston. But Houston
but
is a cool place.
Multicultural place.
Yeah, it took me time to learn that, though, you know, and it took traveling to learn what I had back in Houston.
Oh, is that right?
You know, so, but yeah, I always felt in opposition to the greater, like, culture around, like, the church I went to and my parents' like political ideas, and they're great people, but they wanted to explore Texas for most of their lives, and I wanted to see the world, and, I thank them though, because in a way I had a drive to do more, to go to college and to like get a career. And I knew that if I wanted to see the world, it was going to cost money, right?
Sure.
So,
yeah.
I needed to make enough to see the world before I die.
When you were doing high school, because I To me, it seems like you're a creative guy. But were you more a math guy, history guy, or were you still at that point even a creative guy as a guitar player and all that?
A little of both. I did pretty well in math, actually.
Oh.
Even for a homeschool kid. I think at heart I'm a nerd.
Yeah.
I love science and math. And, mm-hmm. During the pandemic, I took a break from the spirits world because it was chaos in a way. Or we didn't know what was going to happen, I would say. And so I was like, let's try something different. And I ended up being the head of an engineering and design department at a solar company.
Really?
Yeah. Looking at line diagrams and calculating how many amps are going to go through a certain gauge of wire and so I don't burn someone's house down.
Sure.
Now, I realized I hated sitting at a desk once again, and I went right back to spirits. But so I did fine in math. But I learned guitar as a teen, and then I carried that into high school.
Any inspirations there to tour, start a band, record? I know you've done
some
recording.
If I could go back in time, I would have focused more on music for sure.
Really?
Yeah. I always feel happy when I'm jamming in with people.
Yeah.
But it's really hard. If you're not a natural talent or you don't have parents that maybe can support you buying equipment or touring.
Great point. Yeah.
Stifling your future career to explore some artistic avenue, So I didn't have any of that. And I was trying to balance my desire to create in art and music and with reality, which is I need to get an education and a career. And
was that ever an expectation given you were home? Because I don't know what it's like to be home. I moved every 4 years from elementary on, right?
Yeah.
So having parents that say we would love to homeschool you, which I see some merits to that, of course. But does that rally in the face of you going to higher education? Do you understand what I'm saying? Does that cause a conflict because you're like, well, actually, great. Thanks for setting me on my way. I'm in high school. Now I want to go get a degree. Does that ever cause kind of like a conflict?
Well, I think parents homeschool for various reasons. Mm. There are politically motivated people that homeschool because they think like crazy liberals are running the school. Sure. And there are people who, like my parents, are hyper-religious and they think the school's teaching my kid, evolution or evil stuff. That was 100% their thing to shelter me from the ideas of science and what they would call the world or worldly things.
Yeah, sure.
And so that was their motivation. And then I think there are some very bright parents who think the school system is not very good and that they can do better. So, it depends.
I love it because I would not ever say that it's one way or the other. I think you're absolutely right. Depending on it just depends on the parent, right?
Yeah.
But there was there an effort to say, well, higher education for you, Stephen, that's not for you. Sorry, mom says, right?
No, for me personally, and I don't know how much this would matter to other people, but it just wasn't a conversation.
Good.
I think that many parents, it is a big conversation. Like it gets drilled into you as a kid, at least the parents who are driven to get their kid to have a nice life or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's always preparing for school. You got to do your homework because you need to get into a good college, right? You need good grades to get into a good college. That was never really a big conversation. It was more like, praise Jesus so you don't go to hell when you die. So, just very different values,
That seems easy enough. Not particularly. Well,
I didn't find it too easy.
Not easy in that sense, but easy in the sense that it's like, well, what do we do? Well, good, bad, right? There's no gray area. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a bit of comfort in people that I know that are particularly religious because things are just bad and things are just good. It's like, well, what about this? No, that's either bad or good. So it prevents the minutia of living life for one. And being, if you enjoy traveling, being in a place where I'm conflicted here because this is neither good nor bad.
Yeah,
it's good and bad.
All it is avoiding the harder gray area questions of life and not wanting to deal with things that aren't simply black or white. Like you said, it feels nice to be able to make everything a binary, but the truth is everything's on a spectrum or a continuum, right?
And that's why everybody is difficult for people to process sexuality or gender identity, right? Which we won't get into, but I believe they're on a spectrum. Spectrums are harder to understand. Hot dog, hamburger, you like one or the other, that's way easier for people to get.
Is a hot dog a sandwich, though?
Well, see, now this is the gray area. I couldn't say, although I'm open to conversations intellectually about sandwiches.
Yes, I'm big on sandwiches and sandwich debates.
Yes, exactly. But that's good. There's some nuance there.
Yes.
So when you talk about, I'm maybe understanding the journey a little bit more now. Because if you think, what is the antithesis of being homeschooled? What's the antithesis of learning bluntly what another culture is like? And that is with a camera in the middle of nowhere, capturing people. So for you, that particular interest, I imagine it's this amalgam of wanting to travel, but also wanting to experience different things. Is that fair?
Yeah, and you know, tell difficult stories. Yeah. You know, if you talk to psychologists, you know, they rate people's personalities on all these various metrics, and one of them that always strikes me is like agreeableness.
Oh.
You know, some people are quite high on agreeableness, and that means they don't like conflict and they don't like tough situations. They tend to be easy to get along with, and that helps them in certain ways. And I tend to be on the other side of that, where I don't mind conflict. I don't mind debating hard ideas. And I was wanting to go, you know, film the hard things and tell hard stories.
Any particular subjects that you had in mind that maybe you did go to travel for or you had planned to film?
No, I mean, I wanted to do like War and Peace stuff.
Ah.
A lot of like journalists, and I'll probably forget most of their names now, that I used to read a lot, had died though, or
in act, in like in on
location. Kind yeah. Of. And so like, I don't know, there was something brave about that to me, to risk your life to go tell a story of maybe a group that doesn't have a voice.
Yes.
You know, something like that.
I like that.
And then so I just ended up selling alcohol instead. But
well, in a way that is, especially with Compass Box, is you're kind of, there's some dead distilleries that you all work with.
Yep.
There's the unsung heroes of distilling that nobody knows is part of amazing blends they love. So in a sense, it's kind of highlighting people that by no means are they financially displaced, but they certainly don't get the coverage.
Agreed.
You know what I mean? That's why I go back to Bad Religion, right? I was listening to them. I grew up on Bad Religion.
Yeah.
Should they be bigger? In my opinion, of course. But is what makes Klein Leash, for instance, as a blending component, something special because people don't necessarily know? It's quite plausible that it is. And I love many of the blends that you guys use. I was curious because I came across, and I know Pasha, I know Karen, of course, and there was a video, I think, that you filmed of Pasha talking about Spain, was it?
We were in Ibiza, with Jen Mari, or I don't remember how
to pronounce it. Yeah,
And, you know, Pasha is someone I look up to. Not only is his bar amazing, but, like, when you get him in a candid moment where he needs to speak about something, it's one of the most eloquent people I've ever heard. Yeah. And you probably saw it in that video.
I did. Well, he's an asset.
Incredible.
Those guys, you know, I mean, like, not to discount his experience and his career and livelihood and working with Robert Water and stuff. But, yeah, he is. But do you see it as I need to capture this personality, or is it some other kind of vision with the camera?
No, for me, it's more about creating a place where someone can be their most authentic self rather than me injecting any of my own ideas or wants or desires into it.
Yeah. If you were to, because, of course, you travel working with Compass Box, which, again, is one of my favorite things. You know what? Like, if there was a cult punk band in Scotch, we'd fucking know that Compass Box is that.
I describe us as punk rock whiskey makers all the time. Totally. And I think it fits. I think
with just as good of a vocabulary as Greg Graffin from Bad Religion too. Because some of these guys, like, I love Tim Armstrong from Rancid and stuff, but he just yells. I like that. Mm-hmm. Greg Moore, I won't get into more punk rock names, but Henry Rollins is an intellect.
Yes.
Right?
I'm a fan of Rollins.
Yeah, and I feel like that's what you guys are doing, is you're yelling loud and clear, but with elegance and eloquence.
We call it internally, you know, heretics with positive intent.
Oh my God.
You know, so we're not afraid to question authority, but we do it with a purpose behind it.
Yeah.
It's not just, you know, immature rebellion for rebellion's sake. It's,
right,
hey, this rule doesn't make sense, or this isn't good for the consumer. How can we poke fun at this?
I love that.
I don't know if you ever saw one of my favorites is our Deluxe 3-Year Whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
So in Scotch whiskey, you can only put an age statement that's the youngest whiskey in the blend, right? And I think that is ostensibly to protect the consumer so that you can't call something older than it really is or something like this. But it's funny because it's not a very good rule. So we created this whiskey that was like 99% quite old whiskeys. I think they were in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
This is before my time, but I really love this whiskey. And then we put 1% of a 3-year-old whiskey.
Oh, man.
And we called it Deluxe 3-Year-Old because if we wanted to put an age statement, we had to put 3.
Yeah.
Even though it was 99% 30 plus year old whiskey.
Oh, that's cheeky shit, right?
And it's cheeky and fun. Yeah. And it was delicious. So, you know, with a beautiful label, of course, right? So that kind of stuff drew me to this company for sure.
I've been drawn to them as a group of intellects that makes brilliant work. Again, this goes back in American Fiction. If you get a chance to watch it, I suspect it is a perfect metaphor for Compass Box, to be honest.
I'm definitely going to watch
it. It really is. It's a brilliantly acted movie, really well written as well. But I do wonder, because your early days, and I think that it's quite plausible that I went to lay low when you were working back there in Houston. One of my favorites.
You definitely look familiar too. Like, I feel like we've probably met.
Had to, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And also there was, you were working, what is it, in 2012, Okra? I think you were doing an opening or some kind of...
I probably did something there. I never worked at Okra full-time. I was at Downhouse before Alelo, which, yeah. You know, for a while, Downhouse was like the second better bar program in the city next to like Anvil or whatever, because we were taking it seriously and doing the old-timey like pre-prohibition cocktails.
Yeah.
Taking the time to stir them correctly and all that jazz.
Did you find... Because what I'm trying to understand, and I don't think it's a big leap, but you want to go to exotic places, capture the voices of the voiceless, as probably a cinematographer, right? Do you feel as comfortable in front of the camera as you do behind?
Definitely not.
I didn't think so.
I'm a behind the camera guy. Yeah,
I thought so.
I love to be a part of things, but I don't want to make it about me. That's why I think I asked you if I should prepare anything, and you're like, "Yeah, we'll just talk about you and stuff." And I was like, "Oh, geez, can we talk about anything else?"
No, it's funny too because I take it for granted that I consider these all jazz performances. That's mm-hmm. how I look at this, right? Whether mm-hmm. I'm playing drums, you're playing guitar, vice versa. But I don't know where we'll go. I just know that it's up to me to make sure we keep going, right? And that there aren't these blind spots and that we both learn things about each other in the process. That's the thing that's of greatest value to me.
Yeah.
And besides other parts of my life, I've met many people that I adore through the podcast versus that I work at in corporate America, right? Like, it's the proportion of people that I appreciate, a whole different thing, you know. It's very normal in that respect. But I am curious because I get the shift to documentary stuff, right? Like, and who am I thinking of the Thin Blue Line? Errol Morris, one of the greatest, right?
Yep.
I get his approach. But how did you end up serving drinks? Is there something that you find as multicultured and as representative of lost and or diminished cultures in cocktail making as well, mixology? What's the bridge look like?
I wish I had some deep or profound sounding answer.
Me too.
I suspect that there's a giant mix of variables at play, many of which I'm not aware of consciously, that draw me to spirits and cocktails. I mean, so I was a home brewer originally.
Okay.
So really into beer. Yeah. Then I had a long love relationship and still do with wine, but I've never worked in wine. And I never want to work in wine because I never want it to be my job.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, got into the craft cocktail thing during the early days of the cocktail renaissance, right? Yeah. And so there's something that's this beautiful blend of both politics, history, flavor, culture, style, spirits and cocktails. I mean, it encompasses a little bit of all those things. So yeah, there is something deeper there than just like getting drunk or just like boozing it up with people or being social. There's something, if you really get into it, there's something for everyone.
What about the element of caring for others? Because to me, immediately, you seem like a very compassionate, empathetic person. Do those sensibilities as a person come into play as well, that you like serving, in other words?
I do love hospitality. I do love when I'm working at a bar, which is no longer very frequent.
Yeah.
This element of giving someone, you know, that's spending their hard-earned money at your place, a beautiful experience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people have anniversaries, dates, reconnections with friends. All these things happen in a restaurant or a bar. And if you know what you're talking about and you're listening and you're being very hospitable, I think that you can, there's something there. It's deeper than just serving a drink or serving food to someone.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I feel it does come natural, this kind of service mentality.
Given it is somewhat you being on stage, although caring for others, there may be a camera, there may be not. More cameras now, I would say, and more videos. Is that if it's under the cloak of you being in service, do you mind less being on camera and being
a center? Great question, and you nailed it. If I can, you know, if I'm going to be the center of attention for something, I want it to be because I'm working on something, whether it's a film or it's a cocktail or a cocktail program or whatever it is. If it's this other thing and I'm just the vessel of like describing that thing or bringing it to people, then sure, I'm totally more open-minded. If it's just about me, I mean, my mind about people is like, I'm not like a star person, right? I've met some famous people in my life, but I've just as many times turned down the opportunity to do so, even recently. And I won't name names, but I just don't, because like we all put our pants on the same way, right? And we're all human and flawed. And, you know, don't meet your heroes is in some ways a very true sort of adage, right?
Yes.
And so like
Because I want you to conclude that thought. But
yeah.
Have you ever met a hero?
I met Harrison Ford once.
Whoa, really?
And I rode around town and hung out with this isn't really a hero, but an interesting guy, Cheech from Marin, from Cheech and Chong.
Same.
Oh, cool.
I interviewed him and hung out
with him. Oh, nice. Great dude, right?
Really nice guy.
Really interesting guy.
Mm-hmm. This is because of Aaron, I guess, because you're working for Pioneer.
That's just to correct. Just to tie this stuff
360.
That's
correct. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. You and I do have so many mutual friends and acquaintances. It's unbelievable. It's crazy. I mean, the funny story is we're Aaron and I driving Cheech and his like handler to Anvil for a drink.
Yeah.
And in Aaron's crappy little Yaris Toyota and we have Cheech in the back seat. And then he's like, hey boys, you want to smoke? And he like hands us his vape pen. And I'm not gonna say no to like smoking with Cheech. It's like
all right. This is I want to admit and over drinks I tell close friends this.
Yep.
I don't smoke.
Yep.
Do you smoke?
No longer. I quit not too long ago.
That's fine. No judgment.
Nothing against it. No. Yeah. I wanted to be more social.
Yeah.
I just moved to San Antonio, and if I smoke, I'll just stay at home and like write music and play video games.
See, perfect.
Yeah.
So all right. Just don't throw this glass at me, Steven. So I'm in Cheech's hotel room because of Aaron, interviewing Cheech about Tres Papalotes, right?
That's right.
The mezcal from Guerrero.
It was from Guerrero, and it was forget the varietal.
It was Cupriata.
There was another one. There was two.
Papalote?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
It doesn't matter. See, there's a listener now.
Yeah.
So we're drinking mezcal. Now, this is my forte. I've traveled all throughout Mexico. I'm drinking mezcal with people and shit. He's like, you want to smoke? I turn Cheech Marin down. I do not smoke.
You've regretted ever since? Or
I do not regret it because I stayed true to myself.
Hey, that's what matters. But you could have smoked with Cheech.
I could have smoked with Cheech, but I don't smoke.
I had to say yes, but I did partake at the time, so it wasn't like a big leap for me.
Yeah, it's not a leap, but I just find that funny. All right, so back to you being kind of comfortable with being in a picture because you're serving others. That's a fine space for you.
I'm more interested in ideas and things people do rather than people themselves.
Interesting.
That's not just for others, but for myself. I don't expect anyone to be interested in me personally, but maybe they'll...
Really?
Maybe they'll be interested in something I'm doing.
That's interesting. I mean, you do a lot, and you can say "fuck off, Mike." I don't do anything. That's fine. I love humility as much as
never,
the next guy.
I would never.
People say you do a lot. I'm like, I guess that's my answer always, right? Like, I don't give a shit. I just do what I do. But if you do good work, if you expand a brand, if that's on your shoulders and you succeed, are you okay with taking some accolade with that? Taking a pat on the back sometimes.
I'm not super comfortable with it, but that's probably like a conversation I should have with a therapist or something, which I haven't and probably never will because I'm stubborn. But yeah, no, I'm just more interested in things than people. And that sounds so bad now that I'm saying it.
I don't think that sounds
American
bad.
English and out loud. And
No.
Yeah.
I think that, all right, I'm going to say this because I've had problem with women for a long time, even though I've been married a couple times. I've had problem with women.
You and me both.
Do you ever feel, all right, this is going back to American Fiction. There's a whole other aspect to this movie, which again, I'm not getting paid to say this. I just thought it was a great movie.
You're like, Wright, and the sponsor amazing. Of today's podcast is American Fiction.
Indie movies till I die.
Yes, same.
But there's something about the main character. He's in academia, and then he faces a series of familial problems. His mom gets Alzheimer's, so this is not a spoiler for the movie at all. But he realizes he never really opened up to anybody. I mean, this is not meant to be a psychological session, even though that was my minor. But do you feel like you let, romantically, do you let people in?
I mean, it's probably a better question for people I've dated than for me. I think some people have told me I've never felt so comfortable around someone. And then others have told me I've never had such a hard time reading what someone else is thinking. So
interesting.
Who knows? I think chemistry between two people varies depending on the two people.
This is great. I'm watching you write this answer in your head and be diplomatic.
People might hear this,
Well, I think that people might. How about this, which is a clear question, not romantic. I feel lately, in the past few years, one of the most important things for me as I exist is that people understand me, the people that are close to me. Family is different. That's a different thing. I think with family, as I get older, I delve into other things and they get the core me that grew into maybe not something else, but something different, a different flavor. But do you feel like with the people that are close to you that you do feel understood by them?
I would hope so. I only have a few very, very close friends, and some people might roll their eyes because I have thousands of friends and acquaintances, being on the road all the time and just being, you know, in front of people a lot. But when it comes down to like who would maybe be next to the bed at the hospital if I was quite sick or something, there's maybe four or five people like that, right? And I would hope that they do know me. And like I was thinking about, just in case you asked me some kind of question like this on the way here, you know, I would hope that if my close friends that actually know me hear this podcast, that they say, okay, he didn't like dress this up. He didn't like,
that's all I want.
Yeah.
Too.
He didn't try to seem like a different, like, yeah, he was real to like, that's how he really is. Everything he said is exactly how he really feels behind the scenes. So that's what I would hope. Yeah.
No. And I love that because so many brand people, I think it's quite common. They're duplicitous in that sense, right? There's the person that they really are. And then there's the person that you want to believe that they are.
Mm-hmm.
In order to sell the brand. But I think what's beautiful about Compass Box is you can't not be part of the punk rock group and work. You can't fake that shit.
Yes. So I've never felt more at home in a company or in a brand.
Yeah.
Where I could be who I want and it also matches the ethos of the brand, largely speaking.
Yeah. That's incredible.
Very happy. Yeah. Very happy where I am.
Was there a particular moment where you said, I'm done bartending? Because there's been a ton of distributor work that you've done and some brand work.
Yep.
Was there something that maybe it was a toll on your body, maybe ready for something new? What was that transition about?
Well, it's all practical. It wasn't philosophical. I love bartending. I love creating drinks for people.
Mm.
But I was getting older and my feet were hurting. My back was hurting. Ah. Also, I had worked in corporate America a bit before getting into bartending.
The solar powder thing? Or before that?
Way before that.
Oh, okay.
When I graduated high school and started junior college, I did an internship at Enterprise, the rental car place.
Uh-huh.
At the time, they were the largest hirer of college grads in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good place to learn basic business skills and stuff like that. So I worked for them for a while, and I knew what it was like to have paid time off, to have some travel, to have that sort of the cushier parts of corporate America. You're aware of this, right?
Yeah. Of course.
And going back to college and going to work at bars, you know, and at the time, none of the bars I worked at offered healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
None had paid time off. And I just felt like, yeah, it wasn't a real job in a weird way. And I hate to say that because it is. It's an amazing career and it takes so much skills to be a good hospitality person.
Absolutely.
But I wasn't being offered the real job, quote unquote, like benefits, right? And so I knew that it wasn't going to last forever and that I needed to do something else.
Mm.
And what better thing to do if you're passionate about spirits and cocktails than to go work in brand work? To sell out, so to speak.
Right.
I mean, selling out was one of the best, you know, decisions I ever made in my life.
Right. I mean, what is it? So Epitaph Records, right? And I don't know why I'm going so.
I love the music references.
I've been going so. Yeah. I'm listening to so much Bad Religion, but like, Epitaph started because they needed to make Bad Religion. I mean, it's Brett Gerwitz, right? Like he needed the guitar player for Bad Religion, mm-hmm. but which was outside of Bad Religion for a while. And Brian Baker from Minor Threat set up. Doesn't matter. So he comes back. But he starts a label because it's the only way to lift the genre and give more access to it. Offspring are born from this. Mm-hmm. Offspring ended up being massive. You know, and so like it's one of those kinds of things. So it's funny you use the word selling out because that's typically like Green Day has been called selling out.
Yep.
Fugazi never sold out. But like, you know, the AFI might have sold out. Like, I don't care. None of that matters. But for you, did you find it an artful transition that not only were you not selling out, you were finding your way to bring people into the places and the spirits that they might not find a way to access?
I was lucky in that I've never had to work for brands that I didn't believe in.
Yeah.
And I never will, for that matter. But yeah, I was in the right place at the right time to always be working with brands and portfolios of brands that I could sleep at night knowing that I'm offering really cool, really interesting stuff to people.
Yeah.
So yeah, like I'm lucky. Like I would be terrible at this if I was selling like the latest celebrity XYZ or the latest commodity vodka thing.
Have you had to turn down some, not no names, but have you had to turn down some gigs?
Yeah, none of them so horrible I would laugh, but some that like I had to subtly turn down, but like behind the scenes it was really because I didn't like feel comfortable with the brand or whatever.
Got it.
Yeah.
Do you think that, I asked this of someone kind of recently too, I said, I remember who it was, a good man, but he's respected and he's coming up through the ranks. He's just a touch younger than both of us, so he's had a career already in tech. And I said, would there ever be a reason to take a gig that you didn't want to take? Do you feel that way now, where like you don't have to take anything you don't want to take?
I wish that were the case. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not going to starve to death if I lose my job and there's nothing good out there. But in fact, I'd probably go back to bartending for a little while.
Oh, I love that.
It's a good backup plan, like, because I still, you know, I try to keep my chops somewhat sharp.
Yeah.
I just don't think I could compromise. I couldn't go with most brands that I wouldn't go to a brand I don't believe in, I guess is how I'll put it. But yeah.
Yeah, I'm not putting you on the spot. Because it's the same thing. Like, I've had the, you can call it a privilege, luck. I don't give a shit.
Yep.
I've been doing what I want to make, and I've got some strange shit I just wanted to make.
Yeah.
If I sell it, fine. If I don't, fine. Like, I don't really give a shit. Yeah. I just want to, like, do cool shit. Like, and it's not avant-garde. I want it to be accessible, but it's, in a sense, not to compare myself by any means to Compass Box, but I'm trying to make things that the people that love spirits will love. Mm-hmm. And everyone else would be like, that's cool. Right? And so that's like how some of this stuff is. Like Ultramarine is like that.
Yep.
Where it has these hints of things that I know. It's like, this sounds like this to me. Mm-hmm. And then when I looked at the build, then I was like, oh, I fucking knew it, right?
Yep.
Which I think is amazing. But is there a parallel? Because I'm trying to draw these parallels. I think too much. Steven, if you want to know anything about me, I think too much. Although I don't worry too much.
We're kindred spirits.
Maybe, just maybe, like going to, let's say, desert areas of San Luis Potosi in Mexico, which was some of the brands that you had
mm-hmm.
at Pioneer, a couple of those
Mexicans were from. Big fan of Mexico and all the regions where agave products were made, for sure. Yeah.
In a way, by you bringing a bottle to someone and sharing that with them, are you not playing back footage that you took from the region?
Sure. Are you not telling a story?
Yeah, exactly,
that perhaps right. That person who's, you know, at the planque can't quite tell, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Sure. Absolutely.
It's the same kind of thing. And I love that because that's kind of a way that spirits can transport us. Mezcal particularly, but scotch and these blends, very much brought to the coast of Islay and other contact areas throughout Scotland.
But you can only hope to be an honest messenger of it, right? I mean, it's a big responsibility.
That's right.
You're kind of speaking for other people in a way, and their work, and their, you know.
Representing them in a sense,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. And that's where the word that I used to hate, rep, like, oh, you're a rep. I'm like, fuck you. I do a lot of stuff. I'm not just a rep. Like, you're distilling me down. That's very reductive. But now I kind of, it makes sense.
Yeah.
You are a representative in a way, right?
You are, but you've been assigned that. That's kind of the difference. With tequila influencers, I got my own agenda here. But, they've assigned themselves to represent a culture.
Yes.
But when you actually are responsible for the financial livelihood of people, you're no longer just, you're not a rep. You're a dude that's like part of the journey now for these folks, you know?
Yep.
So that's bound to feel a little cleaner and a little more honest, I suppose.
Sure. Yeah.
How did you, well, all right. So I had one of the times I went into Houston, I was having lunch with Karen, a great sushi spot. I can't recall what it was. And, oh, she won't get mad at it. This is fine. This is clean. This is G-rated, essentially. Is it, so for me, because I speak Spanish, is it Corona or Corona?
Well, so it's Italian.
Okay.
My family's from Sicily.
Oh.
So it's more of like Corona.
Corona. Okay.
I speak very bad Spanish, though, by the way. So
this is great. I love it. We can speak.
When I'm in Mexico, I can get around. I don't want to do it here, but I'm already embarrassed enough. But
no need to be embarrassed.
Yeah, no, I'm joking.
But we were having, and I think this was the conversation around. She was still in Houston before moving to London, right? So, and she's like, "What do you think of Stephen Caron?" And I was like, "I think he's got a good rep. Like, I hadn't heard anything, you know, because I got some folks. I'm like, these fuckers, like, don't hire them, you know."
Yeah.
But that was not the case with you. What did the conversation look like when you were approached, or you approached Compass Box for the role?
Luckily, I think I had Pasha on my side from my work at Gin Mare.
Doesn't hurt, does it?
You know, and so I think he probably was one of the people who really put in a word for me, and I'll always appreciate him for that. And I don't know who else. I think Aaron, who we've mentioned a few times, one of my closest friends. So yeah, it helps to have people on your side. And this is why it's important to have a good reputation. One, it's just good to be a good human. Yes. And I'm not saying that I'm one, but I definitely try to be.
Well, no, I've never heard of you not being one.
That's awesome.
For whatever that's worth.
That's great. You haven't probably spoken to everyone, so, you know, but no, like it's not, it's more than practical. It's, you know, it's deeper to, you know, like in be nice, be kind, you know, help people. But if you don't care about that and you only care about yourself, it's still very practical to have a good reputation.
Oh yeah.
Because eventually someone's going to want to perhaps hire you and they're going to ask Mike G's of the world.
Yeah.
What do you think about this person? And they're either going to be like, no, that person sucks, or I've heard nothing but good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's quite practical to be nice to people and do hard work, actually.
I agree. Yes. You know, anytime I harvest plants, formerly known as stool, I'm always out there first, wielding a machete. The team needs to know that I'm really to work for it.
Love that.
You know, but that's really important to me. One of the things that's hard to teeter, I think, because you're, dare I say this word, I hate this word, but this phrase, but I get it. Your online presence isn't necessarily robust. And given your skills as a digital creator, I would maybe suspect it would be more robust. Is that a hard line to teeter for you to reveal just enough that people can understand you as a man, but also understand the brand? Is that a challenge for you, what that online persona looks like?
I think I could be bigger online if I wanted to be. I don't like social media. Mm. And it's more broad, like philosophical impact on society sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a fan of it. I think like influencers, for better or worse, are scumbags. at least the phony ones, you know, who are making, you know, life harder for everyone.
Yes.
And are very phony. Mm-hmm. Authenticity is probably the most important value. Truth and authenticity to me.
Mm.
And again, I fail miserably at times at these values. But
authenticity, really? You?
Well, we're all imperfect, right?
Yeah, of course.
But I really value authenticity. And when I see a video like, you know, you see a viral video of like an influencer pretending to board up a window after a storm, and then really she was just like looking for a photo op and then hopped back in her Rolls Royce or whatever and drives away. And that is like everything I hate about society. And, you know, social media is full of that kind of stuff. This sort of like, let me show you the best side of my life.
Right.
Let me pretend to be something I'm not, or let me value consumerism or this sort of vapid culture of like flashy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just not down with it. And so I just don't engage with it much. However, I know it's important when you work for a brand and you're in a social job, you need to show the value of that brand and what you're doing out in the market and all that jazz. Yeah, so it's weird. It's weird for me. I want, at one hand, I feel negligent and I feel like I should be online more. And on the other hand, I feel like I'm being true to myself by, like, I call it posting ghost. Like, I'll post something I'm doing, then I log off and I don't. And part of it's for my own mental health. I don't know how healthy it is to scroll, you know, doom the feed all day,
right?
To doom scroll. Yeah, there's just, I have a lot of other things to do than to see what everyone's eating and doing all the time.
Generally speaking, do you enjoy technology?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, and I had a small background in I did Cisco networking in high school, which was like a college level course. So I know a little bit about that. All that in technology, as you're aware, it changes so much that you're a few years out and you don't know anything. But I did some minor programming and made like some screensavers. And I had a slight. I'm a video gamer since I was a kid, and I kind of wanted to go into that industry until I saw how hard they work and all the crunch that goes into creating a game. And I was like, no thanks. But
I do want to talk because you're not that much younger than me. That's a positive thing, I think. Any favorite NES games?
Oh, so many. I mean,
give me just a couple you like.
Yeah.
Non-sports, which I think there's great games.
Sure.
What about not first-person shooter that didn't exist yet?
I was about to say there are none on the NES.
Yeah. Would it like a good, relatively violent game for NES?
Oh,
well, that does include boxing. Boxing is incredibly violent.
Oh, well, Mike Tyson's
Punch-Out.
Come on,
for
classic.
That one.
Not only fun, but the cartoon style makes it not seem so dated even now.
Yeah,
just a great game. Just a cool sound effects, fun game mechanics. So, you know, the original Legend of Zelda.
Ah.
I love action-adventure, like open-world games, and that was like one of the early ones, right?
Yeah.
This sort of, we're going to start you out in a world and not going to tell you what to do. And you kind of like bumble around and figure it out. Like you don't even have a sword at the beginning. And
you
have to know to go into that one little cave and the old man will hand you the sword. But if you skip that cave and just start wandering around, like you're going to have a bad time. But hey, they're not holding your hand. And I love that. So yeah. You know,
what about Metroid?
Love the original Metroid games. You know, as those evolved over time, they became these sort of like backtracking fests. And I'm just I'm a little too impatient for that. But yeah, Metroid's great. The original Mario games are great from a sort of a tactile, like hand-eye coordination sense.
Yes.
You know?
I
Mega Man.
Mega.
Love the Mega Man series.
Mega Mans are great. We're both children of the 80s.
Yes.
And I'll make this succinct, even though I'm using pauses. This is the thing you learn about hosting a podcast is use language. And I'm a vocalist too, so you're like, all this fucking bullshit. Contra, still one of my favorites.
I can't believe I didn't mention Contra. So I'm one of those types where you ask me a question and I struggle to come up with something on the moment, then on the drive home, I'm going to come up with like 20 better answers. Contra, I mean, and not only that, the Konami code, right? The
up, down, left, right.
Get you the 99 lives. So one of my fondest childhood memories is just my little brother and I, you know, trying to beat Contra together. Because, you know, those games used to be very brutal. They weren't about selling you loot boxes and keeping your attention for hours on end. They were about like challenging you.
That's right.
And that came out of the culture of arcades where you're putting a quarter in. So the harder the game was, the more likely you were going to lose and have to put more quarters in. And that kind of like transferred over to the early console games.
Yeah.
And so those early NES games were brutal.
I wasn't that good at them. Contra, I was good because I had a code.
Yeah.
Punch Out, I was pretty good. I loved Punch Out. I could beat Tyson.
I mean, Tyson's hard, though.
He's very...
He's one of the hardest bosses in gaming history.
Do you know there was a second Tyson?
In that game?
In that game.
No, I didn't know.
I remember that fabulous Saturday afternoon where I typed in a code that took you to an advanced league of boxing, and you go fight Super Macho Man, Sandman, and then Tyson
again. So no glass jaw in the advanced.
No glass, because you just like, you fucked those guys up.
Yeah.
That was... And I had one chance. And I beat Tyson the second time. And it's a different ending. That's all there is to it.
That's quite the achievement, though, honestly.
I suppose.
I mean, 99% of people will not get why that matters, but I get it.
As long as someone gets it, you know.
Put it at the bottom of the resume. Beat advanced Mike Tyson. Someone somewhere is going to be like,
advanced
he's hired.
Like, this fucking guy. He's got to be head of engineering for us, which was a very improper role for me. So how often do you make it into, you said you, this might, since this is, might not be official news, I won't say it. But how often do you make it into Austin to traverse the cocktail scene?
Well, it's not top secret or anything, but not often enough. But since I grew up in Houston, lived there for 40 years, never lived anywhere else.
Yeah.
And made my first move to another city a whole 3 hours away to San Antonio in November. And then the goal was just to be in Central Houston and Central Texas and, you know, dig into the scene a bit.
Yeah.
Having grown up and bartended and have all these close relationships in Houston, I don't need to be there all the time per se. And I felt like I wasn't coming to these markets enough. So I would say I come to Austin probably twice a month.
Yeah.
And, you know, when my lease is up in San Antonio, I think I'll move here for a
bit. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, and then maybe we can hang out.
I would love that. And I think we have a lot in common. And, you know, I love the vibes here in Austin and the music and the cocktails and food scene is really great.
It can be a really beautiful place.
Yes, I agree. The traffic, you know, not fun, but...
I'm just going to ignore that one. Yeah. I've lived all over, but like I've been here like 20 plus years now.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
I don't know if it's nice. There's like, you can build wide, you can build up. I had that conversation with someone. I've been here too long, but it keeps getting better and easier.
Good.
I guess. Like, all right, this is a question for you. Like, if a place becomes too easy, isn't that a sign to go try a new pasture? A new frontier?
Well, I think we can broaden that out to if anything is too easy, yeah, it's a problem. I'm allergic to too easy.
Yeah.
Or to falling into like going to a restaurant and ordering the same thing because I know that I like it. I don't like safe. I like to challenge myself and to mix things up. And sometimes you mess up because you order that other dish and you're like, this isn't as good as the green curry.
Right.
But hey, you tried something new, right? And you're never going to discover that new favorite dish, that new city that you love or whatever it is, that new band, if you don't give it a chance, right? So,
is constantly learning and experiencing new things, is that a tenet of your life?
100%. You know, I live every day with this in the back of my head that, you know, life is short, not to get too macabre.
Oh, okay.
We're all going to die unless, you know, Elon creates some magical...
I'll still just die.
Yeah, yeah. And most of us will probably still just die.
I'm fine with dying. Yeah,
but, you know, there's a beauty to life when you realize that when you keep that front of mind, or at least somewhere in the middle of your brain, that, you know, this is short and this is not forever. And then all of a sudden you simple things are a little more beautiful, and you don't take things for granted as often. And like, I just want to experience as much of this crazy thing we call existence before I go out. So
it's endless if we let it be.
Yes.
All right. So I got a couple questions left.
Cool.
Which, did you have any idea where this conversation was going to go?
Not at all.
Good. Good. I love it. It's perfect. Well, I certainly don't think you understand where I'm going to go next, which is great. But knowing that you want to learn, you want to expand your mind, experience all the things. Does love play a role in that? In terms of, and I don't know if you're single, it doesn't really even matter, but marriage, kids, is that something too that is, those are frontiers that you want to also explore?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm going to sit here and say that life is about experiences, like how can I ignore, you know, some of the more profound experiences? I doubt that, like, there's many things more profound than maybe having kids or something like that.
Yeah.
But I think it's much more complicated. I mean, unfortunately, like, you know, like, say having a kid or getting married, it requires not only myself, but this other person, right?
Right.
And I have trouble sometimes with people or understanding what they want, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. You know, maybe it's being homeschooled and not interacting with many people growing up that part of my brain didn't develop or something. So, you know, I would never put kids or marriage off the table for myself in life. It comes down to meeting the right person that I trust, you know, has the same values, or at least we can get along long enough to do it right.
Yeah.
So I would love that. In fact, I am single. Just me and my little orange cat, Charlie.
Get a cat.
Yeah, yeah.
Aww. Tabby.
He's a sweet boy, and I love him. And so it's just us two now. But yeah, if the right person came along, I would absolutely love to experience the whole love thing and get married and all that. Jess,
it's, you know, and I'm gonna, because I not turn the tables on you, but because I asked when I was in Houston, I was recording with Rachel Bloom Soto, right, from Makers.
Love her.
She's great.
Tried to call her earlier. She didn't answer.
I think she's in San Antonio doing like a quarter rap or something.
She's in my town.
That's
okay.
What I got.
I just wanted to ask her how her experience with you was. And
yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, to get the inside.
I was just, doing my homework.
Ask
like
Blair
you do.
Too. Yes. See how that was?
I did. I called Blair.
Okay.
She said you were awesome.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
That was a brilliant chat as well.
Blair's great.
This enriches my life, chatting with people like this. But the thing that Rachel brought to my attention, which was very important to me. I was raised by a single mom. Like, I have these interesting sensibilities, and they're different than men, right?
Mm-hmm.
At least in my opinion. And you can ask Kay, my partner, also to get insight if you wanted. But she said, but she wasn't saying it to me because she was questioning the question, because I asked her the same questions, like about love and having family and all that. And Rachel has a particular experience with those things, which you can listen to the podcast, right? But she says, do you ask your male guests that? And she wasn't calling me out. She was just purely curious. And I was like, fuck, I don't know that I do in the same way, and shame on me. So I'm going to ask that question more, because men are just as responsible for understanding fatherhood and as a woman as motherhood. So that's why I asked. And I'm going to continue to ask folks this question.
It's a good question.
I think it is too. And I don't want kids. I really don't. I've been married twice, been able to avoid having kids. And when you talk about kids as being able to avoid them, then that's the answer. Therein lies the answer right there.
But do you hate interacting with kids, or you just don't want?
I actually really dislike it.
So I find that very odd.
Interesting.
Yeah, and you're not alone. I mean, so many people in my generation have this like repulsion to kids, and
repulsion, strong word.
Okay, or dislike. And I'm like,
that's also a strong word. Whatever's in the middle. Ambivalence.
It's certainly not positive.
I have 100% ambivalence. So here's a great example. So just about four houses down, I take a walk every day when I get home from work. And they're out there, and it's this cute gang of kids that are just, I don't know where the parents are, I don't give a shit, but they're just like hanging out. You got a kid in diapers, you got an older kid, you got the cross neighbor and stuff. And like, all that I want them to know is like, y'all do you. And I just like give them a peace sign and I walk by. That's all I want. I don't want to, I want to talk to them. I don't want to have a deeper interaction.
And that's so bizarre to me. Like I, one of the deeper questions that I find myself thinking about is, why do so many people in my generation that aren't already married, that aren't already like, that was my goal from late teens, like, what is this thing with kids? Because, like, you know, you were a kid. I was.
Wait, what are you talking about?
We were all kids, man. And and kids are these, like, hilarious and pure and just, like, ridiculous little creatures that say the most ridiculous things. But they're honest. They're pure. They're fun.
Yeah,
they haven't been beat down by ideology or the world or the realities of adulthood. And I find them amazing. And I worked with kids a lot in my early 20s. And although I don't have one now, it's really just because I haven't been in the right position to do so, because I think it's a huge responsibility that you can't take, you have to take seriously, right?
So. Yeah. I think I equate it to my mind doesn't, adults is, it's a different thing, or family is a different thing. But the few younger children that I've been around with friends, you know, I'm just like, I please forgive me. See, I just can't be bothered. But I'm patient, right? Like, I'm endlessly patient. I'll make time for anybody. But just like watching a kid, and all they want to do is tell stories and be the center of attention for 2 hours. Like, dude, I can't just burn two
they
hours
are a little
listening.
Cunts, aren't they sometimes? Yeah, but right. Hey, yeah.
I don't mind it. This is the final thing I say about him. If you care, I care. Mm-hmm. So the mothers recently in my circle, they love being moms, and I cannot rally more for them because I appreciate that. My mom loves being a mom. That's not my thing.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm not apologetic about it, but I love discussing that because I seldom.
Did you ever stop and think why?
Yeah, there's some reason.
Okay.
I certainly do think about why.
I imagine.
Which ultramarine, we'll drink some of that.
And then we'll get into it when we get enough whiskey going. Yeah.
But so the last question for you, and I'm going to go music on this one just because mm-hmm. I know you play guitar and you like to write music. So you can have. Shit, I mean, you got the hedonist as well, right? Or hedonism, rather.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Let's say you're sipping hedonism anywhere in the world. Doesn't matter where. But you can have a dram of scotch, in this case, grain, blended whiskey, beautiful whiskey, with anybody, musical artist living or deceased, who would you love to just sit and have a dram with? Did Blair prep you for this?
Well, no, but having listened to like four or five of the podcasts so far, I knew this was something, but you mix it up. So you say actors sometimes.
I try to do that.
I think you asked James Saxon, our main whiskey blender now at, you know, writer, which so I prepared for the writer, the actor. I didn't prepare for the musician. You know, and I could just say Tom York from Radiohead because I'm a huge, huge fan and he's an interesting dude. So let's just say Tom York.
I love that.
Yeah.
I would love to. I've heard things about him from folks that have hung out with him and stuff, and I think he would drink with you.
I would hope so.
I think so.
Nice.
Steven finally made this happen after some time. Thanks so much for coming into the town. Really a pleasure, man.
It was a real pleasure.
Yeah, this has been brilliant, drinking one of my favorite whiskeys with some of my favorite people in this whole entire industry. It is really, really gratifying to see you're part of the team. So cheers for that.
Well, thanks for what you're doing. You know, you're interviewing really interesting people and talking about really interesting things. I really appreciate, and you're good at it.
Wow, cheers.
To boot.
Appreciate
that.
So. Yeah. A lot of practice. If you do things enough time, I guess you get
around. How many have you done now? Like,
this is around 365, 400, something
amazing.
Like that.
Amazing. You'll be like Joe Rogan soon with like 10,000 of them or whatever.
Except I won't be an idiot. I'll make it about you.
I didn't mean
not
like
me.
Him. Yeah. No, I just mean with the number of podcasts. Yes, sorry.
This
to clarify.
Will always. Just to clarify, I don't like, it's not that I don't care about.
Strictly the number of podcasts. Well, he lives in your town now.
I don't care about Joe Rogan. I just don't think he's a good interview. That's it.
Yeah, sure. I agree. But yeah,
I don't think he is. But Steven, brilliant. Talk soon, yeah? Sure.
Yeah, I hope so.
Thank you. Well, there we have it. Steven Corona, the Texas market manager for Compass Box Whiskey. A fine gentleman from Houston. I'm surprised our paths haven't crossed sooner. And I will continue to extol the virtues and the beauty and the deliciousness of Compass Box whiskey. You have every possible flavor you can imagine in these bottles, and they're so riveting and they're so intellectual and they're so beautifully designed. Each one of them in their own right is a piece of art. And how much better can it get than being able to drink a piece of art? Steven, thanks so much for sitting down and chatting with me. So glad that we live in the same state. I'll tell you that much. And thanks everybody for listening to Show to V with Mike G. No matter how much you've noticed your voice deepening over the past decade of recording podcasts, or if you can't wait to eat dinner that's cooling on the stove, please keep dancing.